Welcome to Four Star Forum, an exclusive one-on-one series of conversations with the men and women who have ascended to the highest rank possible today in the United States military. Every week, you'll meet a four-star that will take on the most complex military, national security, and geopolitical issues America faces. This is episode 17 of Four Star Forum. I'm your host, Francis Rose. The Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Michael Gilday, says it may take decades for nuclear attack submarines to deploy for the country of Australia. The subs are part of an agreement the U.S., Australian, and British governments announced September 15th. Admiral Harry Harris, U.S. Navy, retired as former commander of United States Indo-Pacific Command. He's former U.S. ambassador to the Republic of Korea. Admiral Harris, welcome. It is great to see you. Thank you for coming on the program. What is your takeaway both from the agreement that we've made in that part of the world in which you spent a lot of time and the CNO's comments that it could take decades for these subs to actually deploy for the Australians? Welcome, sir.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Rose. Let me just start off by saying I'm honored to be on your podcast here. I came on at the recommendation of Admiral Bill Gortney, and I acknowledge my debt of gratitude to Bill. Let me just say thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. To your questions, two of them, what do I think about the Australia-UK-US or AUKUS agreement? One, I think it's a poor acronym, but I don't think at this point in time we're going to get around it. Everyone seems to be using it. What do I think about AUKUS? And two, what do I think about Admiral Gilday's comment that it could be decades before we see a nuclear submarine in the water in Australia? So to the first part of the question, I think it's a terrific idea, AUKUS. I think that our three nations, who were already allied in different ways, we were allied with the UK in NATO, and we're allied with the Australians in ANZUS. I think that our three countries together are going to be able to focus our resources on the challenges and opportunities in the Indo-Pacific. I think it will send the right signal to our friends, our other allies, our partners, as well as others in the Indo-Pacific, that we take this region of the world seriously together, our three countries, and that we're going to position ourselves in military and other ways to get at the problem set that's inherent in the region. So I think it's terrific that we're doing this. I think the nuclear submarine aspect of this is a clear indication that this is something new. This is something different. You know, we've only shared our nuclear submarine technology with one other country in the whole wide world, and that's the UK. And now the UK and the United States are going to share our technologies with the Australians. That's a powerful signal that puts teeth into AUKUS and makes it something completely different than other regional groupings. Now, to your second question about the CNO's comments that it could be decades before we actually see nuclear submarine flying Australia's colors in the water. You know, I'm not a submarine technical expert. I'm not a submariner. I'm not an engineer by trade or training. So, you know, the CNO knows more about this sort of stuff than I do. But I will say that I believe that if the United States and the United Kingdom and Australia are serious about this, we put our hearts, minds, and wallets behind it, our resources behind it, and if we are fully committed to it, in other words, do we have the will to make this happen? I think that the timeline could be faster than what the CNO mentioned most recently. I think it is important to note this is not a simple case of the United States or Great Britain selling a submarine to the Australians. You know, that would not take that long. You know, the other countries have made and sold nuclear submarines to other countries, you know, off the shelf, so to speak. This is an entirely different kettle of fish, if you will. This is about building a nuclear submarine capability, building a building capability in Australia. In other words, Australia is going to build these submarines with American and British technical support, but they're going to build a nuclear submarine in Australia, and they don't have a nuclear industry there. So that'll take a while. I don't know if it'll take decades, like the CNO was quoted as mentioning, but it'll take a while. But again, it's a question of willpower. And if our three countries together have the willpower to do it and the resources to match that willpower, I think we'll get there sooner rather than later.
You said this is a powerful signal. What is the signal that our allies and partners should take away from this? And what is the signal that potential adversaries, particularly China, should take away from this, sir?
Well, you know, I was the Pacific Fleet Commander and the Pacific Command Commander during the years of the pivot and then the rebalance and the beginning of the free and open Indo-Pacific. And I think that through all this time, words matter, and we signal our intent to the world that we were going to pivot to or rebalance toward the Indo-Pacific region. We changed the name of PACOM from U.S. Pacific Command to U.S. Indo-Pacific Command. The services, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, reallocated the command and control of large swaths of troops and equipment to the Pacific. The Army upgunned its U.S. Army Pacific Command from a 3-star to a 4-star. These are all examples of how the pivot and a rebalance manifested themselves. But what was severely lacking, or what was lacking significantly in the pivot and rebalance, was a commitment of resources to actually fund the things that needed to be funded in the Indo-Pacific, whether it was support for partner nations and build up their militaries, whether it was support to upgun our ballistic missile defenses, for example, in Guam, where America's Day begins, or in Hawaii, and the like. We lacked the resources behind the rebalance and the pivot, which is to say, where the rubber of the words meet the road, we fell short. So Admiral Davidson, who followed me at INDOPACOM, he asked for $26 billion top line increase in the defense budget over 5 years to help him do things that he felt was necessary in the Indo-Pacific. I think he called it the Pacific Deterrence Initiative. And that's still being debated, right? I mean, it shouldn't be a debate at all. If we're serious about this commitment to the Indo-Pacific, this is chump change over 5 years when you consider the defense budget is almost $1 trillion, $750 billion. But it's still being debated. I'm glad to see that it's in the House's version of the NDAA 2022, but we have a ways to go with that. So, that's commitment and resources. Now, that's a long way around your question, but the AUKUS agreement, the Australia-UK-United States agreement, this pact, this defense arrangement, this is actually putting teeth behind words. So we have the free and open Indo-Pacific strategy. We're committed to the Indo-Pacific. This is a center of gravity for the 21st century and all the above. But now we have something concrete, something you could grab onto. Nuclear submarines flying the Australian flag is not insignificant. This is a major deal, and so this is putting teeth behind the words. If we get the Pacific Deterrence Initiative approved, that is putting teeth behind words. So that's why it's important. This is not simply another good idea. This is an idea backed by substance. So I'm excited about it. As far as how it'll be perceived by our potential adversaries, including China, I think this is a signal to everyone in the region and in the world, really, that the United States and the United Kingdom and Australia are serious about the waters in which we operate. I've always maintained that the United States is a Pacific nation, always has been and always will be, because of our history and our our interests and our commitment and our people, who are in many ways Indo-Pacific people. And I think that this thing is going to send the right signal to our friends, allies, and partners. And it will also send the right signal that we're serious about this to our adversaries and potential adversaries.
I take your point and agree with it about the clumsiness of that acronym, Harry. it's not the best. One way to change that would be to include other nations in that. Is that reasonable, or would something along the lines of what we've seen in the last couple of weeks be more appropriate if it's U.S., U.K., and the other third country? Or does this become more expansive, like an ANZUS or like a NATO for that part of the world?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, this is early days yet, right? I mean, we're just now beginning to wrap our lips around the term AUKUS. I don't know if it could be expanded, Ken AUKUS, for example, or whatever. But let's get AUKUS underway. Let's get this thing agreed upon, all the parameters and the boundaries of it, and then we can always look downrange on adding people. You know, we've talked for a long time about adding partners to the Quad. The Quad is not an alliance. It's not a defense arrangement. It is a grouping, an informal grouping of like-minded countries. You know, India, Japan, the United States, and Australia. So, I've often talked about American college football, right? I mean, the Big Ten has 14 teams, and the Big 12 has 10 teams. So nothing says the Quad has to have only four teams. And I think you could apply the same thinking to AUKUS. But AUKUS is different than the Quad. The Quad is an informal grouping of like-minded countries who view the Indo-Pacific region in a shared, like-minded way. AUKUS is a defense pact that ties defense allies together, you know, Australia from ANZUS and UK from NATO, but it ties partners, countries that are already allied in a defense way, in a secure together. So it's an entirely different animal, and I think that we would be making a mistake by comparing ANZUS to something like the Quad. You know, that's apples and oranges in a macro way sense, in my view.
It's interesting that you pulled the term Ken AUKUS out of thin air, or maybe it was strategic, but that was actually an issue debated in the Canadian election that concluded last week. And both, if I recall correctly, both the still prime minister and the leader of the Conservative Party in Canada both said, if I become the next prime minister, I'm going to pursue joining that. I mean, there's obviously interest around the world, and there's obviously desire around the world in becoming that kind of a partner with the United States. That's a pretty good thing, isn't it? I mean, it would seem to me that the more friends we have, the better.
On paper, the way you describe it, sure. And Canada is also a defense security ally, formally, of the United States, formally through NATO. And Canada is also an Indo-Pacific country. Canada's west coast makes Canada a Pacific-facing country, and they have legitimate interests in the Indo-Pacific. So could Canada become a member of AUKUS? I don't know. You know, I mean, I'm a retired guy sitting here in Colorado just opining about whatever you ask me. But theoretically, for sure. But, again, I think we need to get AUKUS defined, parameterized, if I can use a made up word there, and then we look to see where we go from here.
Separate from AUKUS, separate from that specific partnership, what are the partnerships that you think will be most useful and maybe most necessary to continue to develop and mature in that region of the world in the coming decade to 30 years, sir?
Okay, well, I think I may have answered that question in a roundabout way in the answer to your previous question, but I think the Quad is really important. So I started advocating for the Quad when I was the PACOM commander in 2016. I was asked to deliver the keynote address at something called the Raisina Dialogue in New Delhi in 2016. It was the inaugural Raisina Dialogue. This was India's corollary to Shangri-La or the Halifax Security Forum or any number of other international security-centric fora around the world. And so Raisina kicked off in 2016. I flew there from Hawaii and delivered the keynote. And in that keynote, I called for the resumption, resurgence of the Quad. The Quad had been an idea that had gained a lot of currency in the early parts of the 21st century. And then in 2008 or so, if it didn't die a dusty death, put down and suspended animation for a long time. But I thought that there was every reason to bring the Quad back, and I gave a speech about that. So I was criticized by it. I think the Washington Post lambasted me for it and other venues. And I'm not saying that that's what did it, but I'm just saying that I started advocating for it in 2016 publicly. Reiterated it in Raisina 2 in 17, in Raisina 3 in 18. I left the military and went off to do other things like you talked about. But I was gratified to see that all the countries in the Quad together came together. And now we seem to have accepted that the Quad is a reality again, and we're moving forward with combined exercises and other things. I was very pleased that one of the first international events in the Biden administration was the four leaders of the Quad getting together, albeit virtually, and putting out a statement. You can't imagine how hard it is to get two leaders to agree on a statement, let alone four leaders to do that, and they did. And I thought the statement was terrific. And I thought the first thing they did right out of the chute was focus on COVID, which tells you that the Quad is not a defensive pact. It's a grouping of like-minded nations that can look at the challenges and opportunities in the Indo-Pacific region and attack the challenges together and embrace the opportunities together. So the fact that they went after COVID as the first thing right out of the conference, I thought was terrific, and is indicative of the power of this grouping in the Quad. Again, though different than the grouping that forms AUKUS.
When you began to advocate for the Quad in 2016, as you just described, did you have a vision for what that healthy relationship looked like, what that mature relationship looked like? And if so, where are we today in the timeline, in the progression toward realizing that, Admiral?
Yeah, I'm not sure I had that vision. You know, I've never been accused of being a visionary or a strategist or anything like that. You know, I kind of live in the here and now, and I worry about the problems in the here and now. And in 2016, I felt one of the problems was the lack of a grouping like this that could go after the challenges in the region. And you can read the PRC into that, the People's Republic of China. I think that we are far along now because we have leader involvement. You know, if you have the involvement of the leaders, if the leaders are leading, then things like the Quad can have a real traction. And the four leaders are leading in this regard. And I think that's terrific. When the president makes one of his first statements in office, you know, the idea that alliances matter, that alliances aren't luxuries, they're essentials. And when his team says things like, alliances make the United States stronger, not weaker, that sends a powerful signal globally. And then you have the manifestations of that idea and things like the Quad and now AUKUS. And stuff like that. So I'm excited about it. I think it's come a long way, and I think there's a long way to go. You know, I don't know what this thing's going to look like 10 years from now, it could in fact be like the Big Ten or the Big 12 or something. Yeah, I don't know.
I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation your ambassadorial experience in addition to your military experience, Harry. What did you take away from the ambassadorial experience that was different from what you understood from your military career about what makes a country view the United States as a partner of choice? A number of your peers in this series have used that term about what the United States aspires to and should aspire to as it builds and matures its partnerships around the world. And I wonder what you learned during your ambassadorial term that was different about that idea than what you learned in uniform.
Well, I mean, there's a lot, Mr. Rose, in that question. I'm going to just take a stab at one area, and if I don't answer the question, I'll take a stab in another area.
Okay.
What makes America the partner of choice is not an ambassador kind of question. It's really a geopolitical question. It's what we offer our friends, allies, and partners. It's what we stand for as a nation. It's this idea of freedom, and in the Indo-Pacific, the idea is free and open Indo-Pacific. You know, we stand for economic sovereignty. You know, we don't try to put our will on other countries, and we have a whole history, 2 centuries plus of our history behind that. And by no means am I suggesting that we're perfect, far from it, but I think we learn from our mistakes, and we are more transparent than not, and we air our dirty laundry in order to get at the ground truth of whatever the issue is on hand. So I think that's an admirable quality. We support our allies. We have World War One. You know, just in the history of the last two centuries, World War One, Korean War, Vietnam War, World War Two, Iraq, Afghanistan, the whole thing. You know, I mean, wars don't end the way you want them to end in all cases. But I think we've been a good ally and partner writ large. And I think that's understood. And that's what makes America the nation that is many countries' partner of choice. Okay. That said, what did I learn as an ambassador? Well, every day was a learning experience. I mean, if you had a pie chart, you know, you'd have one of those cartoons where, you know, it's all blue except one little tiny sliver that's red, and the red would be titled experience in diplomacy, and the blue would be experience in the military, right? So every day was a learning curve for me. I learned a lot of things. I learned that the DOD budget dwarfs the State Department's budget, and that manifests itself in any number of ways. I learned that time matters to DOD. You know, we talk about time on target, and we talk milliseconds, nanoseconds, when you're talking GPS, global positioning satellites, and that kind of thing. Time matters. I learned that in the State Department, time is in flux. You know, time is relative. You know, I learned that the military, I mean, I knew already that the military has all the great weapons of war to bring to bear on a problem set. You know, shortening is Bill Gorton is F-18s, the aircraft carrier, you know, the B-2, the battalion landing team, all these great helicopters we have, the Marines, all the tool sets we have. But the State Department really, you know, the diplomats really have only two weapons to bring to bear. They have time. That's why time is a relative thing. You know, you don't have to answer the phone right now, because a delay might actually be the better course for diplomacy. And the other weapon, of course, is words. You know, words matter, and the State Department and how they talk and how they respond to queries and how they speak, you know, words matter. And those are really, whether it's a spoken word or the written word, those are really the weapons that State Department brings to bear in the world of diplomacy, and that's words and time. And so I learned that. So among other things, I did that. You know, you can go back to in Korea, you know, the Korean language is great, and it can be traced back etymologically to the Chinese. And the word for ambassador is desa, and that means big messenger. right? But the word for commander takes its derivative from the Chinese, which means to command troops, right? And so that's sort of the difference between being an ambassador. I was the president's messenger, right? I'm the big messenger of the president of the United States in the whole scope of issues that confronted the U.S. South Korea relationship. As the Indo-PACOM commander, I commanded 400,000 troops in any number of ways, and I didn't seek permission to do hardly anything. But in the State Department, as an ambassador, because you're the president's messenger, you have to have this almost daily give and take with Washington on what the president's message is on any number of issues. So, that was a big difference. That took some getting used to. And then in a personal sense, the security aspects of our treaty alliance with Korea, I understood that almost intimately. What I didn't understand was the economic and the trade and all those other things that matter to the economic health of our country and Korea and other countries. And I had to spend a lot of time learning that aspect of my job. So, I mean, I suppose if you had somebody who came in from the banking or the financial sector or something like that, they would spend a lot of time thinking about the security dimensions of the relationship and the relationship with the military there, the giant U.S. military footprint in Korea, and all that. So, it's both. But I spent time trying to learn the economic side of the relationship.
Speaking of time, Admiral, I'm grateful for yours today. Thank you very much for joining me on Four Star Forum. You've been very generous, and I appreciate it.
All right, Mr. Rose. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it as well. Thank you.
Next week, General Lori Robinson, U.S. Air Force retired, former commander of U.S. Northern Command and North American Aerospace Defense Command, is my guest. You can subscribe to Get Four Star Forum every week. The program's available now on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Audible, Amazon Music, and anywhere else you get your shows. If you like Four Star Forum, please leave the best review possible on whatever app you use to listen to it. High rankings in those apps help other people find the show. I'm the host of Four Star Forum, Francis Rose. Until next week, thanks for listening.